taking apart the tunnels at any cost. Today, Friday, August 1st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Fighting resumes in Gaza after a ceasefire collapses, and Israeli forces continue to target the tunnels running under the strip.
They're attack tunnels. Sometimes people here call them terror tunnels. But the sole purpose is to infiltrate Israel and carry out an attack.
Also today, we hear how a woman in Minnesota is coping with her husband's death from Ebola in West Africa. And later, ever wonder how new species get their names?
When you name a species, you have a lot of flexibility in how you name it.
Yes, a lot of flexibility. Plus, would you tune into this?
Southwesterly, veering northwesterly, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later.
Britain's fascination with the shipping forecast, that's just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Ceasefires sometimes do break down. That's one of the many sad realities of war. But an announced 72-hour ceasefire, you'd expect it to last at least a half day or so. Not so with last night's ceasefire between Hamas and Israel in Gaza. It collapsed within a very short time. Nicholas Casey is in Gaza City for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him how the collapse looked from his perspective there.
Well, I got up this morning. Actually, I was up the night before trying to report out what was going on with the ceasefire. And, you know, we as the reporters, along with everybody else in Gaza here, thought we were at the end of this, that these 3 days were going to be used for Gazans to be able to get some food and water, but for political leaders among the Israelis and the Palestinians to be able to sort out some sort of permanent end to this conflict. You know, in the morning, there were people out in boats, fishing, going to the beach. I went into the market and started to talk to people who were gathering up, you know, some supplies, getting mangoes, other things. And then not long afterward in the morning, we started to hear the crash of Israeli attacks. I started to see rockets going through the sky back towards Israel, and people started just to go back inside. It was clear that the ceasefire wasn't really a ceasefire, and that was over.
What were they thinking had happened? I mean, it must have been really odd to hear there's going to be a ceasefire and then nothing.
Well, it's not the first time, because there have been a few smaller pauses that have gone on that have been broken. Just a couple of days ago, there was a four-hour ceasefire that was supposed to happen. It didn't include all neighborhoods in Gaza, and the Israelis ended up striking a market that was there, killing about 17 people in the market, including a Palestinian journalist. So these ceasefires can be extremely dangerous times for people who are trying to go out when suddenly the fighting starts to happen in the middle of what's supposed to be a quiet day.
The Israeli Defense Forces says one of its soldiers was kidnapped by Hamas, and we've heard reports of doom on the horizon in Gaza. Israel does not like it when soldiers get kidnapped. How are people in Gaza responding to this situation?
Well, they're also really scared. There's been 1,400 people who have been killed in Gaza this month. And the fact now that there's an Israeli soldier, which is in Hamas's hands potentially, doesn't really bode well for the civilians here. That's just to say, when these soldiers are kidnapped, this is a huge thing in Israel and may really affect the course of how this war goes in the next few days and affect everybody here, including us.
So as we head into the weekend, Nicholas, so what's the level of anxiety in Gaza? And we're about to enter week 5 of this violent mess.
People in Gaza here just don't know what's going to happen next. I got here just after the fighting started, and you could see every day Gaza getting a little bit worse. It started with buildings coming down, children being killed, the morgue running out of space. Now there's no electricity in Gaza. The electricity plant was one of the targets in an Israeli attack. No one has refrigeration anymore. Sewage is overflowing here because the pumps aren't working, and there's no water for almost anybody in Gaza at this point because the water pumps mainly are on the other side of the Israeli lines, the part that Israel has taken now and is using to try to clear out the tunnels. That's also where the water pumps are, so people don't have that. On top of that, there's almost no one that doesn't have a family member that has been killed at this point that you read on the streets. And there are 200,000, actually more than 200,000 Palestinians who are displaced and are not in their homes. And that's more than 10% of the Gaza Strip right now. This place is just coming apart at the seams.
That was Nicholas Casey of The Wall Street Journal speaking with us from Gaza City. Destroying those tunnels in Gaza is a key goal of Israel's military operations there. Hamas militants continue to use those tunnels to carry out attacks against Israeli forces. But the fact that the tunnels exist is hardly news. So why is this a focus of the conflict now? That's a question that Jerusalem Post reporter Ben Hartman has been looking into.
Long before this operation, this war, there were the tunnels which were used for smuggling, everything from weapons to food to Kentucky Fried Chicken to everything. And those are the smuggling tunnels on the Egypt-Gaza border. These are much different. These ones are on the border between Israel and Gaza. They're attack tunnels. Sometimes people here call them terror tunnels. But the sole purpose is to infiltrate Israel and carry out an attack. With these particular tunnels, there's no humanitarian or smuggling purpose. These are there in order to attack. Now, when did the Israeli government or the Israeli military know, and what did they know? They've known for some time. The question is, did they know to what extent this infrastructure was there? Back in October, they had a pretty highly publicized show they put on, where they invited a bunch of the press to come down to the border where they had discovered one of these tunnels. And it was one of these legit tunnels you see now with concrete walls tall enough for people to walk back and forth through, a lighting system, ventilation system. And they found one of these back in October. They invited the press down there. They took pictures. They blew it up. So people knew that they were there, but they hadn't used one yet. And now in this this operation, they're using them again and again. And even though Israel is aware of them, they're still succeeding. And that's what's really bothering people.
If Israel knew last October, I mean, they must have suspected that if there was one and two tunnels, there would be more, maybe a whole network. Why didn't they go after the tunnels then? I mean, that's, you know, the suspicion of something dangerous has never stopped Israel before.
That's the question, is to what extent can you actually deal with them without being on the ground in Gaza? And what most people say is you can do little to none. There's no real sonar technology or seismic technology that you can use or that Israel has at the moment. So basically, you would only find them after they've been found, and you find the entryway on the Israeli side. You find that opening on the Israeli side. Even if you blow that up, or you blew that up from the air or something, that's just going to demolish that first section. And then the people on the other end, in the Gaza end, the rest of that tunnel is still there. The other kilometer or kilometer and a half of that tunnel is still there. So all they would need to do is, when they get to the end where it's been collapsed, just take a right, build to the right, and continue. And there's a whole network of these tunnels to where really, as the IDF, as the Israeli military says it, anytime they find one of these tunnels, if they want to get rid of it, they have to map it and trail it and blow it up, demolish it from the entire way through.
Are you seeing evidence, or have you heard anybody witnessing Israel really effectively trying to destroy the tunnels from the Gaza side? And is it clear how to do that with few civilian casualties?
Well, I mean, the tunnels, if you actually find them, if you actually find the opening, you can take it out without really taking a big civilian toll. The problem is that so many of the entryways, the beginnings of these tunnels, the holes are inside of houses, inside of mosques, inside of clinics and schools. And, you know, if you just want to take these out from the air, you're going to end up blowing up, you know, civilian infrastructure. So they got to do it house by house, obviously, is what they say. Of course, obviously, when they do go to that house and they find that opening and they detonate it, it's not exactly a surgical thing.
Yeah, I mean, given how hard it is for Israel to destroy these tunnels, apparently, don't these tunnels also give the Israelis kind of cover to keep attacking Gaza?
When you say cover, that's implying almost that this is an excuse to attack Gaza, period. I don't believe that's so. I think the second that the Israeli Defense Forces leaves there, they're going to rebuild these tunnels. And all of these communities that are there are going to remain facing this threat. And either you deal with that problem and you get rid of the tunnels, or you just pack up and evacuate these communities. And the second is really not an option for Israel, because the second you start evacuating border communities in Israel because of threats of mortars or infiltrations, you've basically capitulated and you've given the greatest gift you could ever give to Hamas or Hezbollah. And you know, it's a real slippery slope. Once that starts, they just keep moving farther in, and you have to draw the line.
Ben, just a final and practical question. How can Israel know, how will Israel know when they've destroyed all of the tunnels? And will that equate as no more Hamas rockets?
Yeah, the thing is, I don't know if you ever know if you've located all of them. I think you can find 90, 95% of them. But I mean, you're talking about an opening the size, you know, smaller, you know, about what, the size of a manhole cover in, you know, rural frontier areas. It's hard to find all of them. The question now that you're having a lot of people asking, and a big concern now, is, well, what about, it's making people start asking, what about the northern border? What about the border with Lebanon, where you have right across there, you have Hezbollah still armed with tons of rockets and fighters? True, they're quite busy with the Syrian war nowadays and for the last couple of years. But regardless, it's got a lot of people asking, what about the border with Lebanon? How many tunnels are there? And do we know how many tunnels are there? And why don't we get on that the second after we finish this?
Ben Hartman with the Jerusalem Post. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The State Department announced today that two Americans infected with Ebola in West Africa will be medevaced back to the U.S. for treatment. A little more than a week ago, the first American died from the deadly virus. Liberian-American Patrick Sawyer had traveled by plane from Liberia to Nigeria. When he arrived in Lagos, Nigeria, he collapsed, and shortly after, he was dead from Ebola. Sawyer had been living in Liberia and caring there for his sister, who also died after becoming infected with the virus. I spoke today with Sawyer's wife, DeConti, who lives with their daughters in Minneapolis. DeConti told me about her late husband.
He was so full of life. He was bigger than life. He would be in the room, and you'll know he's there. You know, he was a very passionate man, passionate about social justice, democracy. He felt strongly about democracy, and he wanted a better democracy for Liberia. When he became a U.S. citizen and was able to vote for the first time in our last presidential elections here, how proud he was, you know, to be able to do that.
There's a large Liberian community in Minnesota, and Patrick, your late husband, was very involved in that community. How has the community been reacting since his death, and how are they rallying, and what are they able to do for family and friends and the Liberian community back home?
It's just been a wave of emotions. Everybody knew Patrick. Everybody knew him. And so now, you know, we've come together and we want to work. It's, you know, I said to them, I said, it's time we unite. It's time we come together as one and do something together as one people to help the people back in Liberia. So we've come together as concerned Liberians against Ebola, and we've identified two groups to work with. There are two groups that are on the ground that are at the forefront of this fight against Ebola. They've been there since the beginning, and it's Samaritan's Purse and Global Health Ministries. And so we're reaching out to everyone and asking them to please, please donate. And that's why I'm doing these interviews, is to spread that message.
DeConti, yesterday I spoke with Lewis Brown, the information minister for Liberia, and we were talking about the fear during the civil war in Liberia in the late 90s and the fear now about Ebola. Mm-hmm. What's it like for you when you think about home in Liberia and the challenges it seems to continually face?
It makes me sad. It breaks my heart because Liberia went through a 14-year civil war and families were destroyed. And it takes me right back there. My family was able to leave Liberia right before the civil war. And so we were one of the fortunate few. Yeah, but it breaks my heart and it feels like it's happening again. During the civil war, when I was here in the late 90s, 91, 92, it was these phone calls, and I was like 11 years old at the time, and every day was a phone call from Liberia saying who died. Every day, it was like people were dying. Every day we were getting calls. There was constant crying, and it's taken me back there.
DeConti Sawyer, her late husband Patrick Sawyer, died of Ebola this past week after traveling from Liberia to Nigeria. DeConti, thank you so much for sharing your story. Our thoughts are with you and your family.
Thank you.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, simplifying home theater setup with a single device that delivers all cable TV on demand and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Summer is music festival season. It's been ages since I went to one of my favorites in Quebec City. But there was something in the news recently that made me scratch my head about a festival on Canada's west coast. Now, you know, festivals often have rules about what you can and can't bring in. No glass bottles, booze, drugs, sleeping bags, laser pointers, that kind of stuff. But this festival in Canada has decided to ban a certain type of headwear. Here's my colleague Andrea Crossan, who covers all things Canadian.
When I was a kid, I didn't tell people that part of my family was Native American or that my grandmother grew up on an Indian reservation. It just wasn't cool. And hey, I was already burdened with painful shyness and a mouthful of braces. I didn't need anything else to make me a target in middle school. But these days, it is cool to be Native American. In fact, all the kids are doing it. That's Man of the Hour, Pharrell Williams. Last month, the musician and style icon was on the cover of the UK edition of Elle magazine wearing a native feather headdress. And he's not the only one. Headdresses are everywhere. They were the must-have accessory at the Coachella Festival this year, and they've been all over the catwalk, from Chanel to Victoria's Secret. But is it okay to wear a headdress if you aren't Native American?
We don't want to see war bonnet-style headdresses or things resembling them on site.
That's Paul Brooks. He's the communications manager for the Bass Coast Music Festival. The annual three-day event has banned patrons from wearing native headdresses. The festival is in Merritt, British Columbia, an area surrounded by Aboriginal communities.
There's many Indian bands in the area, and we want to be good neighbors and respect Canada's Aboriginal people.
Brooks says he's been seeing more and more people wearing headdresses, and online sites are popping up to cater to those who want to buy the feather headgear.
You'll find hundreds of vendors selling quote-unquote authentic headdresses for around $50 to $100. Often they're made of chicken feathers and other cheap materials.
And a real headdress is not made of chicken feathers.
Mostly these are eagle feathers, and eagle feathers are almost invariably treated as being very sacred objects.
Daniel Justice is a professor of First Nations Studies at the University of British Columbia. He's also a member of the Cherokee Nation. He says that headdresses are traditionally worn by a community member who's been honored as a leader.
It's a pretty big slap in the face, but it's also part of a much longer and much more egregious history of colonial appropriation of indigenous things that are significant, trivializing them, commodifying them, repurposing them for really banal and sometimes even offensive purposes.
There has been a backlash to the headdress as feathery fashion accessory. Pharrell Williams was criticized for choosing to wear one on that magazine cover. He issued a statement saying, quote, "I respect and honor every kind of race, background, and culture. I am genuinely sorry." So if you're going to a music festival this summer, feel free to wear your high-waisted cut-off shorts or your homemade neon bracelets or even your best Stevie Nicks flowy skirt. Just don't wear a headdress. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan.
It's amazing what grabs your ear and what makes people listen. I remember growing up in North Carolina with farm reports on the radio. Hey, it's a tobacco state. When I lived in Togo in West Africa, people used to tune in religiously at noon to hear the death notices on the radio. I get that. Extended families in a small country. You want to know who died. But this next story surprised even little old me. It's about something called the shipping forecast, which our friends at BBC Radio have been airing for a long time. Our producer in London, Leo Hornack, has been checking it out as part of an occasional series about unique uses of radio around the world. You can call it Radio on Radio. Tell us what the shipping forecast is, Leo.
Well, Marco, if I was to just describe it, that probably wouldn't do justice to it. So I'm going to let you hear a little bit first.
Another shipping forecast. Viking north and south Utsira 40s. Southwesterly, veering northwesterly, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later.
What you're hearing is an audio tour around the British Isles. Each of those place names is an area of sea. And effectively what it is it's a weather report, a shipping forecast. It's been broadcast since the 1920s in more or less exactly this style on the BBC. Mm. And for people all around the UK, it's something that they associate with the very end of the day. It's the culmination, the final piece of broadcasting on many of the main BBC radio stations. So wherever you are, you kind of know that the day is coming to an end when you turn on the radio and you hear these slightly hypnotic, somnambulant sounds, these far-off place names, you know, wave-ridged place names that you can hear probably a little bit under my voice right now.
Well, you know, I mean, it's kind of curious because there are lots of people not just kind of using this to note the end of the day, but they're obsessed with this. And they're not even near any of these weather patterns being reported at sea. It'd be like, you know, me listening to a weather forecast from Tierra del Fuego while I'm sitting here in Boston. I mean, why?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. It's funny. I was just talking to some of my colleagues in the BBC office here, and I just mentioned that I was about to do an item about the shipping forecast, and there was instant fascination.
Wow.
I mean, people started to say, oh, but I remember that as a child, and it's something that is a shared memory. It's part of Britain's identity, I think. I spoke to the Daily Telegraph's radio critic, Gillian Reynolds, about this, and here's what she said.
It captures the imagination because it makes you feel part of a community you're not. If you're washing the dishes at 12:30 and you're feeling all alone, there's the shipping forecast to keep you company. You're with other people listening to this strange thing.
And Leo proved the shipping forecast is part of the national identity in the UK. It's actually inspired poetry.
One of the most powerful and evocative uses was by Seamus Heaney, the great Irish poet, the Nobel Prize winner. And he wrote a whole sonnet based on the words of the shipping forecast and also of this idea of an ancient maritime culture that is kind of piped into your bedroom late at night.
Dogger, Rockall, Mallon, Irish Sea. Green swift upsurges, North Atlantic flux, conjured by that strong gale-warning voice. Collapse into a...
And that was Seamus Heaney reading his poem, his sonnet, inspired by the shipping forecast. Leo Hornack in London, aside from people in the UK washing their dishes and getting some late-day comfort from the shipping forecast, is it really needed still?
Marco, that's a very insensitive question. I'd rather you hadn't asked it.
I'm so sorry. Okay. But shall we end it here?
The answer is quite embarrassing that it's probably not. I mean, of course, all the actual people in fishing boats and commercial trawlers, they're not tuning into their long-wave radios at 1 in the morning. They've got GPS and internet access. So if they need to know where the gale is, they have much more immediate means. But that is a rather sensitive topic, and I don't think that there's any chance anytime soon of the shipping forecast being cancelled in this country.
Leo Hornack, thanks a bunch.
No problem, Marco. Thank you.
The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking north and south Utsira 40s, southwesterly, veering northwesterly, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Rain, then wintry showers, moderate or poor becoming good.
And I thought the shipping forecast is the time when the UPS truck shows up. This is The World on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, catching a wave with India's first female pro surfer. She's teaching a whole new generation of Indian girls to get stoked.
I just like try to be a positive role model and just get them to just get in the water, and the ocean takes care of the rest, you know?
Except during monsoon season. That's just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. This week, as we reported on that deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa, we've heard that the highly contagious virus would actually have a very hard time spreading here in the U.S. We hope that's the case, though it is not the case with another tropical disease we want to tell you about now. It cannot kill you or make you bleed from the eyes and ears the way Ebola can, but it has just shown up in the U.S. for the first time. The disease is called chikungunya, and health authorities in Florida have just identified what they say are the first two cases of the nasty disease that were clearly acquired here in the U.S. Carrie Arnold has been covering the story for Nova Next. That's a news site from the PBS science program Nova. What is chikungunya anyway, Carrie?
Chikungunya is a virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes. It's basically been limited to southeastern Africa, but beginning in the 1950s or 60s, the virus began to spread. And last November or December, it arrived in the Caribbean and it caused a major outbreak there.
And like malaria, chikungunya is passed by mosquitoes. Is it related to malaria? Are the symptoms similar?
The symptoms are most closely related to dengue virus in that it causes extreme joint pain and rash.
Right. And presumably pretty debilitating. If you get chikungunya, you probably can't do a whole lot except lie down.
Basically, yes, that's how the virus got its name. It comes from an African name, which means that which bends over, because a lot of people who are sick are in such pain that they can't even sit up.
So tell us about these cases that have these two new cases here in the U.S., because prior to these two cases, I gather people had contracted the disease somewhere else and brought chikungunya here. What's different with these cases?
Right. What's different with these cases, and I believe I read a report overnight that another locally acquired case was reported in Palm Beach County. In Florida, yes, that appears to be unrelated to the previous two cases. What makes this really worrisome for public health officials is that it appears that the virus is now in the local mosquito population. Aedes aegypti, which is the species of mosquito that's transmitting the virus in the Caribbean. So it has a chance of causing a much larger outbreak, because anyone who is bitten by this Aedes aegypti mosquito is vulnerable to the disease.
So can we expect chikungunya to start spreading within Florida and beyond Florida?
Possibly. Most of the researchers that I talked to have been predicting small localized outbreaks. It's not the big outbreaks you're going to see with, say, West Nile, where it just spread across the country in a massive wave. It's only spread by Aedes aegypti, which is located in pretty limited localized areas of southern Florida and the South Gulf Coast.
I'm curious, too, is the range of these mosquitoes expanding with climate change?
Yes. I mean, that's definitely a concern in public health. But honestly, what's really been driving the spread of Aedes aegypti and the closely related Aedes albopictus, which is also known as the Asian tiger mosquito, has been human travel, human commerce, that type of thing.
What measures has the state of Florida taken?
They're working on mosquito control measures, which is pretty much the only way to control this disease. And some of that does involve insecticide use. And others of it involves making sure there's no standing water available where mosquitoes can breed. But Aedes albopictus can breed in as little as a tablespoon of water, which makes eliminating all water sources where it can breed really, really difficult.
What's a cure? Is there any kind of...
There isn't. Pill? It's a virus, and people are working on vaccines, but there's still no cure. It's basically fluids and rest and painkillers, things like acetaminophen, that kind of thing.
Carrie Arnold of Nova Next, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're headed now to a small fishing village on the west coast of Karnataka in India. The Indian Ocean waves pound the shoreline around here. That's fine with Ishita Malaviya. She's a surfer, and not just any surfer. She's India's first and only professional female surfer. And when she's not competing, she's busy teaching Indian kids how to surf at the Shaka Surf School. How are the waves today, Ishita, in Karnataka?
Unfortunately, not so good. Because we're in the middle of monsoon season over here on the West Coast, and we actually can't surf for another month or so.
So you not only teach at this Shaka Surf School, you co-founded it with your friend Tushar Patiyan. What was the idea behind it?
It's a pretty long story. It all started like 7 years back when Tushar and I just discovered surfing when we came to Manipal, which is like a university town where we came to study. And we ran into a group of surfing swamis, some surfers from California, and they pushed us in our very first waves. And ever since then, like, our life changed. And we just fell in love with surfing so much, and we had to try to make it work because surfing is so unheard of in India. And it was, like, pretty out there for us to decide to start a surf school, but we just love it so much. And we basically wanted to spread the joy of surfing in India and spread the stoke. So that was our biggest motivation.
You're in India and you're a woman.
Yeah.
What did your family think about that?
My family was definitely apprehensive at first. I mean, from day one, they just didn't get the whole idea behind it. They're like, first of all, they're like, what is surfing, you know? And you want to do this? Like, you just went to college. Like, why do you want to surf, you know? So it took them a while to understand that it was more than just like, you know, a sport, more than a one-time thing, you know, it was a lifestyle. And now they're like really supportive because they get it. After I took my parents surfing, I think they started getting it.
Oh, your parents went surfing?
Yeah, I take my mom and dad out sometimes and they really love it. So
So it sounds like you're pushing cultural barriers as a woman surfer in India. How does that actually play out when you're in the waves? I mean, do guys ever drop in on you as if you're not even there, or is it kind of friendly?
There's a lot of cultural barriers in terms of like, when I see like other women or other girls who want to pursue surfing, their families are apprehensive about maybe them getting darker, you know, like skin color is a big issue. So it's not considered beautiful to be dark.
Really?
So naturally, when you surf, you get tan. In Western countries, that's like looked upon as a good thing. But in India, it's like suddenly you're not suitable for marriage or things like that. And in India, like just generally, there's a major fear of the ocean, you know, like people just don't feel safe in the water. And so just encouraging women to get in the water has been quite a challenge.
So
I feel like it's slowly changing.
What do you tell Indian kids, especially the young women, to get them psyched?
I just like try to be a positive role model and just get them to just get in the water, and the ocean takes care of the rest, you know. I don't have to do much. Just have to persuade them a little bit and, you know, be supportive and warm and welcoming.
What do you prefer, competing in professional surfing events or introducing Indian kids to the sport?
Oh, definitely, like, spreading the joy of surfing, hands down. I mean, I'm a pretty new surfer, you know. I've only been surfing for 7 years, and I've so far only been competing, like, within the country and just representing, you know. I spend most of my time at my surf school teaching all the local kids and girls how to surf, so, and people who come from the big cities. So, and I've seen people go from being like terrified of the ocean to like just loving it, you know, and feeling so confident and empowered, and to be able to share that feeling with someone, you know, and like, it's really special. So definitely spreading the stoke.
You've picked up on some of the West Coast lingo, stoked, I see. What about some surfing lingo from India? Anything you can share with us?
Oh, I don't think we have any.
Well, you need to start making some words up then.
Yeah, but Tushar and I came up with a word called Namaloha, which is a combination of namaste and aloha, which means the same thing.
Oh, I'm going to so use that. Namaloha.
We have a surf camp called Camp Namaloha, and I think it goes really well.
Ishita, Namaloha to you. Thanks very much.
Namaloha. Shaka.
I love it. You can see Ishita spread the stoke, as she likes to say. We have an awesome video of her out in the waves in Karnataka at PRI.org. Staying put in India for our next story, the country's new Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a Hindu nationalist and a big proponent of the Hindi language. One of his early decisions is to give his speeches only in Hindi, as opposed to also using India's other official language, English. That's a problem for the 3/4 of all Indians whose mother tongue is not Hindi. Many of them consider English a more neutral language. So Modi's emphasis on Hindi has millions of Indians worried about the future of their languages. One that may be especially threatened is Urdu. I know, I also think of Urdu more associated with India's neighboring rival, Pakistan, but there are still more Urdu speakers in India than there are in Pakistan. Sonia Paul spent months studying Urdu in the Indian city of Lucknow. Here's her story.
Going into it, I knew that learning Urdu would be a daunting task. But I had a leg up. It wasn't going to be completely new. Several years ago, I'd studied Hindi. To the untrained ear, Hindi and Urdu sound similar. They share a lot of the same vocabulary, but they have different scripts, and they have different connotations.
Actually, I come from a Muslim family, and since we were kids, we were supposed to read Urdu.
I met 21-year-old Nusrat Ansari in Lucknow. She was auditioning to perform Dastangoy, an ancient Urdu storytelling art that's being revived. Ansari told me that as a child, she spoke mostly Hindi.
At that point of time, I wasn't that interested in Urdu, so I didn't take it up properly. But once I went to college and I had a bit of a cultural thing, so then I thought, okay, I should learn Urdu.
What do you mean by cultural thing?
I started engaging in all sorts of activities, cultural revivalism activities and all that. Dastan bejna afrasiyab ke.
Hindi and Urdu are so similar that when Nusrat was listening to the lines she had to memorize, which were in Urdu, she wrote them down in the Hindi script. Artist Mahmood Farooqi has been reviving Urdu storytelling. He says reciting Urdu is a sign of prestige in India.
I mean, our TV, television anchors like to use Urdu. Parliamentarians like to use Urdu poetry. Political leaders, even Modi recites a couplet or two, you know.
But you won't find India's new prime minister giving a speech in Urdu. Because he's such a staunch advocate of Hindi, many people are wondering whether his new language policies are part of a larger plan to wean out languages like Urdu. Whereas Hindi script stems from Sanskrit, Urdu traces its roots to Persian. It was born in India around the 15th century, when Persian began to mix with local North Indian dialects. Mehr Farooqi is a South Asian languages scholar at the University of Virginia. She says that by the 18th century, Urdu was an important literary language in India.
Just like English is now, in the sense that it was a language of prestige and it was considered to be the language of educated people. So everybody studied Urdu and therefore they spoke Urdu also.
But about 100 years ago, Urdu started to decline in India. The British wanted a common language for the country, and more people wanted Hindi to be that language. And Hindi and Urdu, even though they were so similar in spoken form, became symbols of religious difference.
It became like Urdu equals Muslim and Hindi equals Hindu.
This is why the new government's promotion of Hindi is so controversial. It puts a spotlight on India's post-colonial division into India and Pakistan. Storytelling artist Mahmood Farooqi says it was another setback for Urdu.
You had a lot of Hindu nationalists and Hindu fundamentalists saying Urdu created Pakistan, so let's ban it. There was a lot of discrimination against it in schools. It wasn't taught. The government did nothing to propagate it or to help its cause. And that continues to be the state of affairs today.
And while some people, like Nusrat, are motivated to learn Urdu, she says the language is struggling.
I wouldn't say that, you know, it's very popular and everybody understands it. That's because most of them haven't been exposed to it.
This exposure will be harder to come by if the new Hindu nationalist government keeps favoring Hindi over India's other languages. That would only compound the problems Urdu's already facing. But there are about 50 million native Urdu speakers in India, and others, like Nusrat, who are rediscovering the language through its cultural heritage. So while Urdu may not have the same dominance in India it once did, it looks like there might still be a place for it in the country. For The World, I'm Sonia Paul. Sirf sa se hi to
baki hai jab teri. A little romantic tune in Urdu, just to get in the mood, though I think there's some Hindi mixed in there too. Sonia's report is just one of the many language stories featured on our podcast, The World in Words. You can find more at pri.org/language. And one more little story before we head to the break. Would you do this first thing in the morning? Singing at dawn. This is in the main square of the Danish capital, Copenhagen. You see, this year's Copenhagen Opera Festival has kicked off, and the man running it thinks it's not just the pros who should be belting out the tunes.
My name is Mikael Bøjesen. I'm a conductor and a composer, and then I am the artistic director, manager of the Copenhagen Opera Festival. I hope that we will get a movement in Denmark that in firms, in factories, in schools, in every place in the parliament, that the Danes would sing maybe once a week or maybe every morning. Because I really think you cooperate much better with a colleague if you've been standing together next to a person singing together. You can't be mad at that person. So I would love if this could be a movement that spread all over, saying, let's sing together.
And so each morning this week, Boysen has been gathering everyone and anyone in the square and getting them to sing together. Cool idea. Shall we try it right now? Ready? Set. One, two, one, two. Oh, we got to go to the break. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World on your radio. Just the other day, we reported how Uganda's Constitutional Court was reviewing the legality of the country's Anti-Homosexuality Act. That law criminalized the promotion of gay rights along with, quote, aggravated homosexuality, with a possible punishment of life in prison. Today, the court struck the law down. Lester Fader is covering the news out of Uganda for BuzzFeed.
They ruled on a very narrow basis. Basically, what they found was that when Parliament held a vote on the bill on December 20th, there was no quorum present, which means that there weren't enough members in the room to have it be considered a valid vote. This had been something that was raised by the president's representative in Parliament, the Prime Minister, at the time, and he was perceived as being wanting to just shut down the vote because the administration was concerned about the impact of international donors. The Speaker ignored him, and today that seems to have come back to bite them.
What have you heard about reaction in Uganda from the LGBT community?
I mean, from LGBT people seem to be elated. The couple people that I've spoken with and what we can see on Twitter is a real feeling of a new beginning. It's kind of funny, though, because in some ways the state of law hasn't changed very much. Under the pre-existing law against homosexuality, which was put in place when it was a British colony, homosexuality is already punishable by up to life in prison. And in fact, that's exactly the same punishment that was struck down today. Because the case only dealt with this procedural question, that law is untouched. We haven't seen a lot of prosecution under that law, and we haven't seen the kind of political use of that law that we saw with the Anti-Homosexuality Act, which included shutting down human rights organizations allegedly for promoting homosexuality. So the climate is certainly different, but, you know, Uganda remains a very difficult place to be LGBT.
Right. And this ruling did not address the human rights aspect of the law, rather the absence of any sense of human rights. So is the LGBT community in Uganda also maybe jubilant but worried right now?
I think there is a lot of worry. I spoke to a couple people who were in the court right after the ruling, and the LGBT activists immediately went underground. I think there's a possibility of some unpleasant things happening in the next few days while this news sinks in.
If the law was struck down on technical grounds, one would presume that Uganda's government might appeal the ruling. But I gather the U.S. and the U.K. and other Western nations had been pressuring President Museveni to annul it. So is an appeal even likely?
The question of the appeal, I think, is open. What is clear is that when the law was passed initially, it was passed by surprise to the president and his officials. And if there's a way for the president to put a stop to the bill without directly appearing to do so, he might find that an attractive option to preserve good international relationships that he has remaining. There is the possibility of an appeal here. There's also the possibility that Parliament could simply vote on the bill again with a quorum. But if that's the case, that the president doesn't want to see the bill, there are a lot of tools at his disposal that could make it disappear without a direct confrontation.
Lester Fader, foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed, thank you very much for the update.
Good to talk to you, Marco.
Okay, no segue here. Just finally today, scientists recently announced that they've identified a new species, a water mite, and that they've named it after Jennifer Lopez. That made our own Shirin Jafari wonder just how many other species are named after celebrities and why.
A few years back, a marine ecologist named Paul Sickle and his team were doing research on a fish parasite that exists in the Caribbean. And while they spent hours dissecting fish and gazing at samples under the microscope, Bob Marley was playing in the background. I wanna love you
and treat you right. When we're working in the lab, we often play Bob Marley music. We have a lot of our pieces of equipment are actually named after Bob Marley songs or phrases in Bob Marley songs. So Bob Marley sort of permeates our research.
So when Sickle realized they'd discovered a new fish parasite and it needed a name, he knew what to do.
And so, when I think of Caribbean, I think of music, I think, of course, of Bob Marley.
That's how Nathia marleyi, a tiny tan-colored fish parasite with red dots, got its name. You might think it's rare for scientists to name new species after celebrities. It's not.
40 or 50,000 new species are being described every year.
That's James Hankin.
I'm a professor of biology at Harvard University, where I'm also the director of the Museum of Comparative Zoology.
Hankin says if you find a new species, you get to name it. And of course, that can get very interesting. Just listen to this clip from Discovery Channel's D News.
And last year, an arachnologist discovered 33 new species and went on a friggin' binge. Aptosticus Stephen Colberry, Aptosticus Angelina Jolie, and Aptosticus Sarlacc for the Sarlacc from Star Wars.
Yeah, scientists have your back, Star Wars fans. And there's more. There's the Beyonce horsefly, George W. Bush beetle, and Barack Obama fungus. The list goes on. So here's how it works. Say you find a fish that you know has not been identified before. You write up your findings for a peer-reviewed journal. Once it's published, that fish has a name. The scientists I spoke to say they wouldn't name species after themselves. It's just too arrogant. And there's actually a value in giving organisms a famous name. Here's Paul Sickle again.
Regardless of the reason that people are doing this, you can see the impact that it has. We would not be having this conversation if it wasn't for that. So by naming it after someone who has name recognition, especially an artist, you engage a lot more people in the conversation about biodiversity.
I head over to Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology to meet up with one of the curators there.
Lots of different shells and...
His name is Gonzalo Giribet. One thing I was wondering, what about the famous people? Bob Marley didn't ask to have his name on a fish parasite. Would he be upset?
No, I think that it's still an animal. It's part of an ecosystem. I don't think people will be offended for that.
If anything, Giribet says, scientists name new species after famous people because they admire them. They appreciate their contribution to art, music, or politics. And he should know, since he's named hundreds of new species. Other colleagues have named not one, but two genus after him.
When you're at a party, do you tell people you have species named after you?
Not really. No. Most species, you know, actually, once people see them, they're not as excited. Oh, really? Oh, is that the species name after you? So they imagine that, you know, they might have named like a new whale after you or something like that. And it's really, most of the species are not. Most of the species are small, they're cryptic. They will never see them.
Speaking of whales, I kind of like the idea of having a whale named after me. Scientists, are you listening? The name's Shirin Jafari. For the world, Shirin Jafari.
You heard it here, folks. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.